Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com, the Liberty Radio Network, and No Agenda Global Radio.
All right, this is Michael Dean. We're doing an interview with Dick Dale here, the father of Loud. How you doing today, Dick?
Good.
Good. So a lot of people know you as the father of surf guitar. You call yourself the father of Loud because you've influenced a lot more than just surf music, including metal, shred guitar, punk rock, and just guitars being really, really loud. How did that happen?
I don't call myself the father of Loud.
Oh, okay.
I don't call myself anything.
Okay.
They call me that when I'm doing concerts. When I go to France, like I'll be playing in France, and they'll put me on the cover of their heavy metal magazines and call me the father of heavy metal, and they say I'm louder than Motorhead, and they say all kinds of things. They have all kinds of descriptions of what they call me because I'm loud.
Well, you helped develop the first really loud Fender amps, right?
That's right. We made the first, developed the first output transformers. That's what creates volume. And in those days, in the 50s, when I was experimenting everything for Leo Fender, he was like my second father. I blew up over 50 of his amplifiers because they were only, you know, using 10, 15-watt output transformers. And when you're pushing amperage so much that the wires heat up on the speakers, they heat up and they disintegrate, and they also cause the speaker to catch on fire. Even when I was in London, I was playing at the Royal Albert Hall, and my bass player was going, "Dick, the speakers are smoking." I go, "Shut up, keep playing." Leo would say, "Why do you have to play so loud?" And it's because I wanted my speakers to sound like Gene Cooper. And because he had his rhythmic sounds listening to the natives, and his rhythms became on the one, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, and that's when they would pound their spears into the ground. On the one, where musicians, they count on the one and. So people of the earth, they count on the one. And that dates all the way back to conductors conducting a symphonic orchestra with a baton going 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4 1. So, you know, to give you an example of musicians versus earth people, grassroots people, a drummer, for instance, when they do a turnaround on their drums, we call it a turnaround, they'll start with their snare. They'll go to the rack toms, they'll go to the floor toms, and kick on the bass drum and smash on the cymbal. And they'll go, for instance, it'll go like this. Da-da-din-din-da-da-din-din-da-da-two, da-da-din-din-da-da-three, da-da-din-din-da-da-rest. They don't hit anything. And then they go, 1 2 3 4, 1 2 3 4, 1 2 3 4, 1 2 3 4 1. Well, when the guy is counting in the audience, banging his head, when he comes to that rest, he's going, where is the sound? Because the band usually breaks before they go into a guitar solo, a bass solo, a drum solo, because that's on the offbeat. What it should be is da-da-din-din-da-da-din-din-da-da-two, da-da-din-din-da-da-three, da-da-din-din-da-da-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka- attack on the one. And that's what the natives do, the indigenous tribes all over the continent. And even in the martial arts, which I had been in since I was in my teens, that's been my lifestyle. The Shaolin Temple never allows you to touch the skin of a drum for years until you can tongue what you're going to play with your hands. And that's a whole other story, which I'm going to include all of this into a DVD that my wife Lana and I are going to finally make about how and why I play instruments the way I play them and how that is to be. And as I was saying within the Shaolin Temple, they make you tongue what you're going to play, going when you like a drummer would go 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4 1, you would go ticka 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 ta. Now you're impregnating that into your brain instead of trying to just memorize rhythms. You impregnate that to give a muscle memory, so that when you have it down and you're no longer the grasshopper, you will sound like this. And you could hear the downbeat or the accentuation for the application for the rhythm. And that way, you will, if you ever drop a drumstick or anything, you'll always come back in on the one instead of spending half the song trying to figure out where the hell you are. And I taught my son that, Jimmy, on drums, because drums was my first instrument. Gene Krupa was the first person to make drums a solo instrument in big band music. So I taught my son Jimmy that when he was like 12 and a half months old. And he's been, he does solos with his feet and spins a stick at the same time. And I mean, he does stuff that is uncanny, because I taught him the Krupa method. Then he took heavy metal drumming, took everything else and put it on top of the cement root of Gene Krupa, of the world of indigenous tribes, because that's where Krupa got his sound. So I do that on my guitar. So when I play my guitar, if I'm doing like type of solo playing, same way with Mizzaloo or anything I play, I go, I play the guitar like I'm picking, like I'm playing with drumsticks. And that's what they call it, the machine gun picking technique. Now, by doing that, I was wiping out all these amplifiers because I wanted the volume to be up really high. But the speakers couldn't handle it because they were like 6, 8, 10, 12-inch speakers, along with the small 10, 15-watt output transformers. So Leo, his partner, not his partner, the gentleman who worked from Hawaii, called Freddie Tavares, he played the Hawaiian steel guitar for Harry Owens, one of the most famous Hawaiian songwriters. And he came over from Hawaii to, at the request of Leo Fender, to perfect the Telecaster. And he did. And Leo wanted him to stay with him and work. And he said, no, I record for Harry Owens. But Leo said, I don't care. You can record for Harry anytime you want, but I would love to have you work for me. Because the man was a genius, that Freddie was a genius in playing a guitar. And he became Leo's right-hand man. And when I met Leo Fender, he had just made the Stratocaster. And I said, my name's Dick Dale, I'm a surfer, and I have no money, and I'm starting to play at a place called the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa, where every big band in the world had played. And he said, here, play this guitar and tell me what you think of it. It's a Stratocaster. I picked it up and I held it upside down backwards like I did my first ukulele, and because I'm left-handed, and I started banging on the strings, and he just about fell off the chair laughing. He says, why are you playing like that? And I said, well, the book never told me to turn it the other way, stupid, you're left-handed. And I just continued playing the ukulele that way. Then when I picked up my first guitar, which is another whole new story, then I turned around and I said, how am I going to play all the strings? And the guy said, only just play your ukulele chords and muffle the other two strings. Nobody will know the difference.
Wow.
So I started playing all my Hank Williams songs and country music that I loved, and played the guitar for the longest time that way. And then when I came to California and I was playing at the Rendezvous Ballroom, we opened that up after it was closed. And because of, they tried to bring jazz back into the era with the big bands, and it just folded, and they lost about $80,000. So they closed it and they were going to tear it down. And that's a whole other story why I opened up the ballroom, how I was able to open it up against the police department's orders and all the city orders, because they felt that at that time in the 50s, music was devil music, and they didn't want to allow people to have concerts. And they could only dance the horn bands, not guitars. Guitars represented dirty music and devil music. That's what they told me. And that was another, that's another story. Yes, and how I got the first permits. So Leo was dragged into, we built up the performing at the Rendezvous to 4,000 people a night, which the building was the extremity of the capacity, because all the kids, word of mouth, and the kid, it started with 17 surfers that I was surfing with, and in a building that held 4,000, two stories high, and they said, man, you're the king of the surf guitar, and well, historians, it's so funny, they think they really know the story, and they really don't, because they weren't there when I was doing what I was doing. I became Leo Fender's number one guinea pig. Anything that came out of his mind, I tested. Everything to the Fender Rhodes piano, which I opened, I tested that at the Hollywood Bowl in California when it first was invented. I tested the Fender Contempo organs. We created the Fender Precision Bass, you know, we had the Stratocaster was created in 1954, and all of these different things I pioneered with him. Well, he was, Freddie brought him into the middle of the 4,000 people at the Rendezvous Ballroom, and Leo saw what I was trying to say. In those days, we didn't use microphones in front of amplifiers, so the amplifier had to really produce its own sound. And sure, it was good for like when we had 50 people. But all of a sudden, when you get 200, 300 people, let alone 4,000, the body would soak up the bass resonance. So it sounded thin and very weak. So Leo said, back to the drawing board. Now I know what Dick's trying to tell me. I remember he woke me up around 3 in the morning one time, and he said, Dick, I got it, you got to get down here, I got it. And so he made the first, they called it the Dick Dale Transformer, the first transformer that was 85 watts, and it peaked 100 watts. That's like going from a VW to a Testarossa in those days. But we needed a speaker that could handle it. So we went to JBL Lansing. First of all, they were brothers, and Eltic Lansing and JBL, they split up, and we went with JBL. So we said, we want a 15-inch speaker with an alloy cage to set it in, and with about a 10 to 12, 11-pound magnet in the back. And I wanted aluminum dust cover in the front of the speaker so that I could hear the click of the pick. They thought we were crazy, and they said, what are you going to do, put it on a tugboat? Because they never had anything like that. And Leo, very quietly, he was a quiet man like Einstein. And in fact, we used to sit on the living room, his living room floor in his house, listening to Marty Robbins on a little 10-inch Jensen speaker, you know, in his little amplifier that he had. He didn't like stereo. He didn't like gadgets or anything like that. He liked monaural, now sound. So anyway, he said, if you want my business, make it. And they did. And we built a 3-foot high cabinet, 2 feet wide, 12 inches deep, packed it full of fiberglass, no portholes, and we wanted the sound to push the speaker in and out, in and out. And then we plugged it into an amplifier that he nicknamed it after watching me standing on top of my speakers and my cowboy boots rocking them back and forth. Called me a showman. He says, "You're such a showman." So he called it the Showman. So it was the single Showman with the DD transformer in it, 85 watts, peaking 100 watts. And that, as I say, changed the world of electronics for the guitar. We also changed things in the guitar, you know, with Dick Dale five-position switch and all kinds of other little goodies. But that's another story on the Stratocaster. So then I was still tweaking the speakers. And the reason why they were tweaking is because when I was going with that power, it was causing the speaker to twist and not go in and out properly. It'd go out at an angle because it was getting confused from the signal that I was putting in with high power machine gun picking, they would call it, or I call it Gene Cooper picking rhythm. So we took the speaker back into JBL and we said, "Listen, put a rubber coating all around the ridging so that it'll be very flexible properly." So they coated it, and we call it the little power pack we put into it for the cone. And to this day, I have never blown one of those speakers. I play through them as we speak today, all my original stuff. But in the interim, they rot after so many years, so we had to replace them. But the thing is then I wanted to put two speakers in it. So two 15s in the same cabinet. And Leo says, "Oh my God, what am I going to do?" You know, he says, "I'm going to have to make a different output transformer." So he worked endlessly, and he came up with a 100-watt output transformer peaking 180 watts. That was making people's ears bleed. That was the difference of going into an F-16 to the Blackbird going 2,000 miles an hour. You know, but anyhow, that's what I play through now, and it was called the Dual Showman because of the two speakers we put in there and the Gale output transformer. To this day, this sound has never been equaled, and because of the transformers that are made, favor highs, mids, and lows. We only favor one of the other. They don't favor all three. But in the way he wound the transformer, and in fact, halfway through, he wound it backwards, and nobody could figure out why, it favored all highs, mids, and lows. So it was a round, powerful sound, which caused my speakers to sound the depth of Gene Cooper's drums. So that's how we created the Dick Dale sound, and also me playing through 60 gauge strings, which critics call them bridge cables. Guitar strings in those times were 6, 7, 8, 9 gauge. Well, mine start at 16 plane, 18 plane, 20 plane, and then 39 wound, 49 wound, and 60 gauge wound. And that's what created into the Dick Dale sound. With the speakers and output transformer, you had to have that combination and the Stratocaster, the guitar. So that was that for that. But here's a little bit that the historians think they know, which they don't know. And they say, "Dick Dale sound, yeah, king of the surf guitar. He plays he makes that the surf sound, the wet splashy sound." You've heard that said before, right?
Yeah.
Using the reverb?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the reverb was not created to make surf sound. My sound first came from the scream, came from the sound of Gene Cooper's drums. The way I picked, the way he played his sticks, that's the way I picked. Then the other sounds came from the big slides to hear, where you hear woo, stuff like that. I was raising animals from all over the world, lions, tigers, leopards, gorillas, elephants, everything. I've had hawks, eagles, falcons, sea lions, all the different kinds of things that I had been working with. I had over 40 to 50 species, and I was doing that to prevent poachers from killing them and putting them into extinction. There are no more wild African lions in the jungle. I slept with them. I ate with them. I did all these different things. I used to lay in bed with my African lioness, which I wouldn't let anybody do because people get killed all the time.
Do you still have them?
They don't know what the hell. Huh?
Do you still have them?
No. When my son was born, he started playing with the tigers. And he's coming in and he's going, "Hey, Daddy, look, I got some claw marks. You know, I'm going to be a trainer." I thought, "Jesus, they're going to eat you, Jimmy." So I had to give them up to my friend who had a full-on compound. But I did that for over 35 years. Well, when I'd come home, and my mountain lion would see me coming home, and it was time for him, he wanted to eat, they'd go, "Wow!" like that, and I would do that on my strings. When my African lion wanted to eat, it would go every day at 5:30. It'd go real low, and I would do that on my strings. With my elephant, I had a baby elephant I was feeding. You know, I'd put my hands down in her mouth with the food, the fruit, and rub her tongue, and she would scream high. And I would imitate all these sounds on my strings. In fact, I showed Hendrix, it was before he was Hendrix, all these slides and things like that. That's a whole nother story. So it went to that. And then when I was surfing, then the surfers, well, I'd be in a tube, and I'd put my finger in the wall, and I'd hear the shh going across. So and then when I get thrown over the falls and chewed up and spit out, you know, I would imitate that sound on my guitar. But it started with Gene Cooper, then all my animals, and then Mother Ocean. And it was my surfer friends who called me King of the Surf Guitar. And that stuck. And that's how that title came. Now, the first album I ever did, called With Me Surfing on the Cover, it was the first commercialized album like that, with a person actually surfing on a cover. That was called Surfer's Choice. That sold over 88,000 albums just in my concerts. And that's like 4 million today. Now, the song Mizzaloo, and Let's Go, which created the movie Pulp Fiction, which people don't know, but Tarantino explains it. That's another story, how he created the movie listening to Mizzaloo. That's why Mizzaloo became the opening title song, because he kept playing the song over and over and over again. He did things backwards. Most people do a movie, then put the music to it later, watching the film. Well, Quentin did it backwards. He plays a record over and over and over, and he visualizes the power and the energy of the song and creates a movie from that. And that's how he created Pulp Fiction.
Has he done good by
you?
Has he done good by you?
Here's the way I am. The way I am is, I don't like people in show business because I can't stand talking to a can of beer. It's the same damn sentence over and over again. And they're weak-minded because they allow their body to follow their mind, and they destroy their body. I've never had a drug in my body in my life, even dealing with cancer for the last 8 years, and dealing with diabetes, dealing with renal failure that I'm in, dealing with bladder destruction from radiation and chemotherapy and stuff like that. I've been through 9.5-hour operations with three surgeons where my life just about ended more than once, and my wife, Lana, being a nurse, taking care of the veterans in St. Petersburg, Florida, where she was born, she saved my life three times when I was in an emergency for 12 hours. Five doctors couldn't see what was wrong, and she went in and said, "Excuse me, can I see that ear monitor, and she has, gentlemen, he has three fistulas. You know, those are holes from radiation. My body was infected. And I had been performing in Europe for the last 2 years, and my body was infected. My wife saved my life three times. That's another whole story, a book to write about. And she's no longer being a nurse. But, yeah, we're two sickies ourselves. She has her own problems, like fibromyalgia throughout her body and a Herschel tumor in her thyroid and her throat. So we, you know, as I say, we're a couple of sickies taking care of each other. And when I do tours, we share how we treat each other without using all these pills and crap that will kill you. And because we do research, she does. So that's another method, reason why I tour and I perform, because those people come to me with these diseases and talk to us, and they bring their children. So I get 5-year-old kids with me and everything like that. That's a whole nother story.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
How many shows a year do you play at age 75?
Well, I just got through doing 33 concerts in 5 weeks.
Wow. I don't do...
Let me answer the thing Tarantino.
Yes, please.
I've always been the rebel in the business. When I saw how crooked it was. Because money becomes greed in the minds, and every time they give me lifetime achievement awards, I have to give a speech. And when I do, I say everything that the main agencies, the main record companies, the main companies do not want me to talk about. And what I do is I tell the young kids not to sign these contracts because they give up their rights to their copyrights of their music. These people are only loaning them money. They're like a bank, and they're taking it out of their performances, out of their copyrights, out of everything, and they don't own anything in the end. That's why they get so screwed up. So I tell them all this, and that's why all the major companies, they hate me, because I've been this way all my life. But I don't care. I tell it like it is. Because I just do what I do. My wife and I do it ourselves. And she's the same way. No drugs, no booze, no alcohol. So now, ever. And so now, what happened is, when Tarantino came to me, he gave my bass player, while I was on tour, a note saying, I'm Quentin Tarantino, I would like to talk to Dick Dale. And my bass player didn't know who he was. So he threw the note away. and so then Quentin found me later in my dressing room, and he said, Dick, I've been listening to your music for 1,000 years. He says, you are a master. And he said, the way you play Miss Lou, he says, that's a masterpiece. He said, could I use your song and play it over and over and over and over? And he said, I just want to impregnate my brain with it to see the energy force that'll cause me to create a movie. I want to create a masterpiece of a movie that'll complement the masterpiece of your song, quote unquote. He even said that on the Johnny Carson show. And I said, yeah, because he was very humble. And I've done things with certain people. Like I just finished I just did Glenn Campbell's last album on one of his songs, because he used to play guitar for me. I've done stuff for Keith Moon and everything else. And he was always stoned out of his head. But I never went to their parties because, as I say, I can't stand talking to a can of beer, the same sentence over and over. But Tarantino had the door slammed in his face all the time. So didn't John Travolta, because he was typecast from his first movies. So he couldn't get a job. So Quentin Tarantino gave him that position in that movie. And because I'm a pilot also, and I have my own airport here, but nothing like John Travolta. Look what the movie did for him now. But I loved it when Travolta was going to be in it, because he's a pilot too. So, but Tarantino was such a humble man. It's just like a gentleman called John Peel at the BBC in London. we were soulmates. And I just did a whole thing on for John after he passed away. And I only deal with people who have been through life and they've come out understanding what it was all about to become and remain a good soul within themselves. You know, so, you know, he who speaks does not know. He who knows does not speak. That's why I've always been with Buddhist teachings of the way it should be. One and one is two. It's not three. So, you know, there's no gray matter in my life. I just tell it like it is. And that's the reason why the big companies don't like me, because I tell the kids not to do certain things. So, you know, that's basically it. I'll help everybody that I can who comes to me with open arms and an open heart. And that's the way it is. And Tarantino was one of those guys.
Excellent.
And so, you know, it not only helped me. Look what it did for John Travolta. He's flying jets, for Christ's sake. I only fly a twin engine. And, you know, he's got a huge, giant airport himself. I says, I only got about 81 acres with my airstrip on it, my two airstrips. But up in the mountains, you know, and in the high desert, I'm right next to the Marine base in 29 Palms, California, the largest in the country.
Yeah, and my friend Bruce is your pizza chef, huh?
Yeah. We go there all the time, and he makes our submarine sandwiches and Rocky's pizza.
Yep.
And the Rocky family were very special people, and that's the reason why Lena and I, we go there, because their food is excellent. It's above expectations, and we just love it. And as I say, the family and the people that are there are very special people, and that's why we do what we do. We go overboard, you know, to help others that are humble and good people. I can't stand people in the business that try to be something that they're not. But you can understand what drives them. I can tell. In fact, when I do my DVD story, I'm going to explain what drives people to be the way they are, their insecurities. Or their minds failing to be strong, and don't worry about, Jesus, how long is this going to last? You know, or they get this power of adoration, and it drives them right over the cliff, and they kill themselves with booze, with drugs, with everything. And I've been doing this since 1955, and I'll say it again. My wife and we have never put a drug in our body, and we've never put alcohol in our body. We don't smoke cigarettes, and that's why I created a T-shirt. There's a picture of me on one of the T-shirts looking into the sky. I was sitting on the end of the boat, my boat, and it just says, "Your body follows your mind." And in the martial arts, if you are trained by good masters, I mean real masters, they will teach you that to experience is to know is to understand is to tolerate, and to tolerate is to have peace. That's third eye. It took me 18 years to understand that, and another 18 years to apply it. How can you get mad at an idiot? They don't know any better. So don't try to change them until they look into the mirror after they've lost something great enough to make them realize what life and how precious it is. So get rid of your ego, because you should only have an ego to take a bath so you don't stink when you go in the public. And I'll give you another saying from real deep masters. And monks, do not use this, because it is for earthlings, as we call them, who walk this earth. Thoughts become words. The monk does not speak. He does not speak his thoughts. He only smiles. And the reason why he doesn't speak his thoughts is because people, the word that destroys everything, businesses, marriages, friendships, is called perceivability. What we perceive things to be are not what they are perceived to be, from the giver to the taker. So you could say something, and the other person will say, no, it ain't that way. And say, no, I didn't mean it that way. And before you know it, they're going to get in a fight because the guy perceived it to be differently. So the monk doesn't want to screw around with people's minds. They're happy with living with what God created, animals, our Mother Nature, our flowers, our surroundings, the geographical surroundings, and plant your own food and make your own things by your hands. So if a monk gives another monk a gift, a carving, a bowl, or whatever, he doesn't say thank you. He looks, bows, and smiles. And later on in his life, he might make something and give it back to the guy who gave, the other monk who gave it to him. So they don't worry about using words because they're dangerous. Now, I'll finish it. It'll say, thoughts become words. So be careful what your thought is, the way the word comes out of your mouth. Words become actions. Be careful of what those words are going to do to create an action. So thoughts become words. Words become actions. Actions become habits. It's the same thing all the time. Habits become your character. And your character becomes your destiny. So think about that. Thoughts become words. Words become actions. Actions become your habits. Your habits become your character. And your character becomes your destiny. So that's the reason why we've always loved animals. There are only two pure things on this earth, void of deceivability, fear, evilness, and that is a baby animal and a baby child. And what becomes of them is what we do to them. If you yell at a child, he's going to cry. If you hit a child, he's going to cry. If you yell at an animal, he's going to wince away. If you kick an animal, he's going to run away or soon later bite you. And the child will grow up biting you also in other ways. So you see how important people should be when they are in any form of occupation, whether you are an interviewer or you're a painter or a sculptor or a musician. When kids say, Mr. Dale, how do you play the guitar that way? I say, sit down, son, and let me cleanse your soul. And what they do is they sit down and I tell them it's all an attitude that comes out of you, that goes into your profession. So don't live upon sensationalism. Live upon what unfortunately does not make news. Live upon good things. Everyone reads the National Enquirer for sensationalism. And that's the problem with people. They don't like that. They don't even... News is not a dog coming up to you and wagging its tail, but let the dog get run over and they'll show it to you. Let a child get hit and killed, unfortunately, and they'll show you their little raggedy doll for the next 8 hours just to thrive upon it to gain points on the ratings. Why don't you leave the people alone that were parents to that child and let them grieve by themselves instead of putting it over and over and over and over in the media, which is crooked anyway. So the whole thing in a nutshell is my music is a door opener because I play to all ages, all walks of life, every style, every different instrument, every style of music I can play. I play by ear, and my son does too. We created two new guitars for Fender. Check out Dick Dale's acoustic Malibu guitar, Jimmy Dale's signature acoustic Kingman guitar. My music is nothing but a door opener to people that enjoy what we do. And when we get through playing, we sit and we talk with everybody and we sign. We're at the merch table and we do what we're doing. And they always come back with their families. And that's basically what Dick Dale's all about.
Wow. I am stunned. I had...
I'm stunned.
I had about 25 questions for you. I think I asked two of them and got a bunch of life lessons instead.
He says I was going to ask 25 questions. I asked two of them and I got a bunch of life lessons instead. Don't tell me what time it is. I'll tell you how to build a clock.
Yeah.
And that was part one of three of the interview with Dick Dale on the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. Tune in over the coming weeks at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com. Kitty Feet, like the feet of a cat. Kittyfeet.com for the rest of the interview. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com, the Liberty Radio Network, and No Agenda Global Radio.